Welcome, everyone, to the fifth season of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion's Continuing Learning Series Alumni Learn. This is a special project of our president, Rabbi Aaron Pankin. I am Dina Stein, Alumni Engagement Coordinator and Director of Alumni Learn. During this session and throughout the year, you can always reach Alumni Engagement at alumni@hcc.edu. I'll share with you some technical details about the session momentarily. We at HUC-JIR are excited to bring you the latest in research and learning from our fantastic faculty. This year, we are pleased to offer online opportunities for learning focused on Israel, Parashat HaShavua, latest thinking in our faculty's research field, mentoring the future, best practices for fostering future Jewish leadership, and mini courses taught by our most well-known faculty. A full list of session speakers and times can be found on the Alumni Learn site. That's huc.edu/alumni-learn, including recordings from our previous sessions this semester, as well as all of our sessions going back to the first season. Today we are honored to present a special session with Rabbi Andrea Weiss, PhD, Trending Values, Urgent Voices. I will introduce her momentarily, but before I do that, I want to say a few words about Alumni Learn. Any associated materials or recommended reading from this session will be posted on the ancillary materials page. That's huc.edu/alumni-learn. Shortly after this session, you will receive a link for an evaluation of today's learning. You will also find this link posted with the recorded sessions in the ancillary materials. Please take a few moments to fill out this brief evaluation. Your feedback will assist us in providing future learning that meets your interests and needs. If you wish to provide future comment, or further comment rather, please email me at alumni@huc.edu. You are encouraged to ask questions to today's presenters. You are also encouraged to participate in today's learning. There will be opportunities during the session where we will let you know to unmute your phones, press *6 to participate. And we encourage you to please do participate, please add your voice, add your comments and thoughts. It'll make this session incredibly engaging, more engaging than it is, and we look forward to having your participation. If you have any technical difficulties with today's session, please write in the chat box or email desupport@huc.edu, and our team will be happy to assist you. And now I want to welcome our speaker. Rabbi Andrea Weiss, PhD, is Associate Professor of Bible at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. She is Campaign Coordinator for American Values Religious Voices, 100 Days, 100 Letters, and served as Associate Editor of The Torah, A Woman's Commentary, URJ Press, 2008. She has published Figurative Language in Biblical Prose Narrative, Metaphor in the Book of Samuel, and articles on metaphor and biblical poetry. We are incredibly excited to have you with us, sharing the work that you've been doing with this very important project. So thank you so much for joining us. Again, if you have questions, you can write in the chat box and there will be opportunities for you to add your voice to the session. And if you have any technical difficulties, email desupport@huc.edu or write in the technical support chat box. And now I would like to turn this over to Rabbi Weiss.
Thank you, Dina. So thank you for spending part of your afternoon or your morning, depending on where you are, with us at Alumni Learn. So I offered to teach this session as a way to give some background on American Values, Religious Voices, and also to give some examples of how you might use it in terms of teaching and other material. So I thought I'd tell a little bit about the story of how the project came about, and then we'll have a chance to do some text study and some looking at the project more in depth. So like a lot of, most of my good ideas come while I'm walking my dog, and this is one of them as well. And the idea for American Values, Religious Voices, 100 Days, 100 Letters, came about in the wake of the election, as I had been thinking throughout the campaign of just how divisive the campaign was, how it really seemed to call into question a lot of fundamental American values that we, or at least I should say, had always kind of taken for granted, and just felt really destabilizing and disoriented in the wake of the election. And I thought about how a lot of those values, like pluralism and equality and compassion and acceptance, are not just American values, but these are values that are connected to our various religious traditions and values that are rooted in a lot of our different religious scriptural texts. So it occurred to me that this might be an opportunity for Bible scholars or scholars of scripture more broadly to have an opportunity to have a voice in the public conversation, and that while it's hard for one individual to feel like you can have much of an impact, that if we could get together more of a collective voice of people speaking out about American values that are connected to our various religious traditions, that we might be able to have an impact or have a larger voice in the more public conversation. So I had this idea of sending a letter a day for the first 100 days of the new administration by scholars of religion that we would send to the new president, vice president, Congress, and cabinet that would articulate core American values that are rooted in our religious traditions. And I had the idea that they would just be a one-page letter, both of that was both easy to read and also is an easier ask for scholars who get asked to do a lot of different things. So I had this idea in the days after the election, and the weekend after the election was Symposium 1 at HUC in New York. So I had a chance to see Rabbi Aaron Pankin and to pitch the idea to him, and he was enthusiastic about it and offered to provide funding. So with that as a start, I then sent an email to an old friend of mine who's a graphic designer in Philadelphia, and I asked her, I sort of had a general sense of what this project might involve, that a project like this would involve sending letters to probably electronically sending letters to the explicit addressees in Washington, but then that there would need to be a platform for a much broader implicit audience, which, sort of have a website to be able to publish the letter. So I wrote to my friend Lisa, and I said, I have this idea, and would you be willing to volunteer your design expertise to help me with a website? And I have to say that now that we're over halfway through the project, I did not have any idea the immensity of what I was asking for my friend Lisa. And I think if I had known, I might not have had the chutzpah to ask her, but she knew exactly what a project like this might involve. But when she got my letter, she was also feeling rather despondent in the wake of the election and looking for something that she could do and wondering how she could use her skills as a designer to make an impact, and to somehow she really felt like she was just really hurting in the wake of the election and had to move forward in a productive way. So she got my email at the right time and said yes right away. So at around the same time, I also, about the week later, went to a Bible conference. It was an annual conference that takes place by the Society of Biblical Literature, American Academy of Religion. And I went there with a notebook, and I started writing down lists of scholars that we might be able to invite to include in this project. And anyone I could, I met for coffee, I met for a drink, I met for lunch, and started just taking down names of people who might be good to write for this project, and just generally getting people's read on whether or not this was a good idea. At the same time, I reached out to a couple of people that I knew that I wouldn't be able to do this, certainly wouldn't be able to do this project on my own. Just as a background, I'm a Jewish Bible scholar at a Jewish seminary. I went to the University of Pennsylvania for my doctorate, which I studied with all Jewish professors and all Jewish students. So I come from a very narrow world, and this was conceived of as being a very broad interface project. So those are not connections that I have. And so I reached out to a number of friends and mentors who I thought might be willing to work with me on this. And so I started to put together an advisory committee that included Mark Smith, who happens to be my neighbor down the street, and he's my teacher and mentor, and he was at NYU, and now he's at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's a Hebrew Bible scholar, but comes from a Catholic background, and Elsie Stern, who's a Bible professor and the vice president at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, and we've been old friends since our days at Camp Swig in California. And then I reached out to a New Testament scholar in the New York area who was quite enthusiastic about getting involved in the project, Deirdre Good. So that sort of was the heart of the advisory committee. And then I introduced myself at that conference to a young African-American scholar, Herbert Marbury, and asked him what he thought about the project and whether he'd be willing to be on the committee, which he agreed to do. And then I reached out to a man named Hussein Rashid, who's a Muslim scholar who does a lot of interfaith work. So that was our advisory committee. And so our first step was to try to put together a list of people to invite. And so I'll show you, I have this chart that I carried around for about 7 weeks. I started putting together, initially we had about 120 names, and we decided at the beginning that we put together a list of about 100 people that we would invite to be part of this project, and we crafted an invitation spelling out the details of what we wanted, we were asking from people, and a sense of a timeline. So we started sending out invitations in early December, and it took us about 7 weeks till basically the day the project launched on January 20th to get a list of 100 scholars. I ended up, altogether, we sent 180 invitations in order to get 100 scholars. And one of the animating visions of the project was to put together a really diverse group of scholars who would be able to really, who would really embody and illustrate the kind of diversity that defines America, and I think was really what makes America great. And as we were sending out invitations, I kept a tally, you know, how many African-American scholars did we have, how many Hispanic scholars, how many Muslims, how many Jews, et cetera, how many women, how many men, just to try to make sure that group of 100 would be as diverse as possible, and just kept reaching out to more and more people. Not sure what happened there.
Andrea, try talking again.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better.
Okay, I somehow the speaker button got clicked. So anyway, so I was telling the story. So we eventually got 100 people, and at the same time, I started working. I met the Sunday after Thanksgiving with my friend Lisa, and we very quickly got together the name American Values, Religious Voices, and within a few days, we had a Facebook page and a Twitter account, and I have to say as background, I was never on Facebook before this project, not on social media at all, so it was a pretty steep learning curve for me. And within a few days, she had developed the whole visual, the visual look of the project, and we were on our way in terms of the design perspective. And she was also, reached out to a web designer who also was looking for a way to contribute to something bigger and broader in the wake of the election, and he volunteered all of his efforts to design the website. So all of the design work has been completely pro bono, which is a just remarkable part of the project. We also I recruited two rabbinic students from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion to also help me, particularly with the social media piece of it. So that's been a collective effort. So that's a little bit of background about how the project got started, and now I wanted to show you sort of the results of that by first walking through the website, and then we'll study some text together. So, Carly, I'm going to share my... Carly, is it now...
Yep, we could see it.
Okay. So this is what the website looks like. And I think I hope you'll agree about the how terrific the whole design element of the project is. And so the first part of the website, we give some background on it. This is where we find the letters and the authors. But this is the part that I really wanted to show, which is this grid of the 100 different authors. And as I mentioned before, this is really an animating vision of the project. I had this idea early on that if we could put together 100 faces on one page to really show, you know, this is what America looks like, and people of all different ages, colors, backgrounds, all on one page that are all Americans, all talking about the values that we share and how they're connected and grounded in our various religious traditions. So this is one of my favorite parts of the website, is this grid with all the different, the wonderful mosaic of all the different faces of the contributors to the project. And then if you click on the Meet Our Authors, that's also where we have all the bios for the different authors. You can read more about them. And for people whose letters have been published, you can also, their link to the letters. But it's a pretty impressive and very diverse group, which you can get a sense of just from the just looking at some of the first couple of people that come up. So that's the authors. And then this is the letters, which we'll look at in a minute. And you can see today's day 54. So they come up on the website in this way. And we also have these categories on the side, which is how, so when I put the letters into the website, I highlight keywords, and that allows you to have, to be able to connect letters that are on a similar theme. So for example, we're gonna look at the issues of the stranger. So if you click on the stranger, that will bring up all the different letters that are tagged for that category. So that's a great way to be able to put different letters in conversation, which is what we're going to do in a minute. The other piece of it that I wanted to show is the artwork element. Excuse me. Oh, you know what? I'm not going to take the time because I'm not logged in here. But if you're on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram, there's also been a tremendous amount of art that Lisa and her studio have created that goes along with each letter. Maybe at the end, if we have time, I'll show you some of that. But both every day when the letter appears, there's a quote that goes along with it, and also there's various quotes and other things that we've put onto the Facebook site. In fact, I'm just going to can you see this this screen, Carly?
Yes, we can.
With the tile that comes up?
Yep.
With the red tile in the middle?
Yep, we can all see it.
Yeah, we can see everything.
Okay, so this is just an example. This is from Twitter. These are the pull quotes that we publish every day to go along with it. And then along the way, every Thursday we put a schedule up, so that shows you the authors that are coming each week. And then we also have other design elements. So we did something for International Women's Day where. Then we have other graphics. So, for example, this is one of my favorites. This is we call the Awesome Girl that was inspired by one of our letters that had the refrain, "What do we tell our daughters?" And we've also had, let me see if I can find, we also put up, this is another example. This went with a letter by Christine Hayes where she talks about the teaching that everyone should have in their pocket, two pieces of paper, for me the world was created and I'm but dust and ashes. So Lisa was inspired to make that to go along with the quote. And then we'll put things up periodically. So this is a picture of the categories. We also have, we've put feedback that we've received that we'll also put, that Lisa turns into art. So this is some examples of some of the feedback that we've received, or the way that people have described the project as an archive of compassion and democracy, a beacon of level-headedness and morality. So you'll see those quotes. This is a piece of art that one of the designers in Lisa's office created to go along with a letter about refugees. So we have some design elements as well. So that's just an example of the different kind of art that's been created for the project, and that's we put that up at on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, and we also have an Instagram account, all at Values and Voices. So that's been an interesting part for me to see the way that art and the visual piece has been really helpful in a way to kind of communicating the message and the larger project. So I'm going to pause here to see if, before we actually study some text and look at some actual letters, if people have any questions just generally about the project.
Hi, it's Dina. I have, and for all the participants, if you would like to ask a question, press star 6 on your phone and you will unmute yourself and be able to ask a question. We just ask that you please press star 6 again to mute yourself when you are done. You can also post a question that you have in the chat box. So my first question is, how has the response been from this project?
The response has been really great. We both, in terms of sort of the kind of feedback that we've received from people, which I'm gathering together in a document, as people, I just got an email yesterday from someone who told me, she lives in the South, and for her, these letters are really a lifeline for her, or people, are just finding them. We've gotten a number of people who say that this is now, because the letters, we've set it up, or I set them up each week, that the letters are published at 5 a.m., which means that for the first 100 days, I'm getting up at 5 a.m. every day to make sure that the letters go off okay, and that's when we post on Facebook and we tweet about the letters. Because for a lot of people, that's the first thing that they get in their email every morning, is if you subscribe, which you can do on the bottom of the website, then you'll get the email saying today's letter 54, and you click on it, and that brings you to the letter. So for a lot of people, that's now what they do first thing in the morning, and they read it. People have described it. They just got an email today about someone who really reads it religiously every morning. Other people describe it like a prayer or a meditation, a devotion, kind of centers them during the day to read these letters. I think they've, especially because I don't think we couldn't have anticipated quite the impact of the project, because I don't think we anticipated just how destabilizing the first couple of months of the Trump presidency have been, and especially I think in that light, especially the first couple of weeks and months, that these have just been really reaffirming for people to read these letters, and sort of the ideas and the sentiment have meant a lot to people.
Thank you.
Anyone have other questions about just sort of more the project more broadly? Okay, if not, then let's go ahead and study some text together. So, Carly, if you can put up the handout. Great, thank you. So, given the events of the last couple months, particularly the executive orders of the Trump administration and the rhetoric of the Trump administration, the actions, that it's not surprising that a lot of our letters have concerned the care for the stranger, the vulnerable, and immigrants. And that's both a reflection of that being a very real issue in our nation right now, and in terms of the policy implications and so that issue being very much in the news, but it's also an issue that's really central to, as we'll see in a minute, to our shared religious traditions about how do you treat the stranger and the vulnerable. And if you go onto our website and click on the categories that say the vulnerable, the stranger, immigrants, those are the categories for for which we have the most letters. In fact, I'm editing sort of the last batch of letters now for the second half of the campaign. And there have been cases where we have, where I've gone back to people and say, this is like the fifth letter that refers to the same New Testament passage or that refers to this, that's taking on this issue, and either can you do something different with it or, you know, kind of taken in a different direction, or is there another issue that you might want to address? Because we have a lot of letters on this topic, but we anticipated that that might be an issue. We did not give people direction as to what to talk about or not talk about, except for that they should be core American values that are connected in a religious tradition. But we kind of figured that over the course of 100 letters that there would definitely be overlap and that there would also be diversity, and that's been the way that it's played out. So I thought we could have an opportunity as a way to see the letters but also do some text study to look at some of the biblical texts that are really, that articulate the foundation of how do we treat the strangers. And with Passover coming up in about a month or so, these also seemed like a good topic for study this afternoon. So we'll start with the passage from Exodus 22:20-23, which is where this is part of the covenant code, the legal section in the book of Exodus. And this is where we have, you know, one of the initial articulations of this theme of how to treat the stranger. So in the passage begins, v'ger lo toneh v'lo, so establishing that you should not wrong the stranger. And we have actually a couple of verbs that are used to emphasize that theme. And then we're told not to wrong the stranger, ki gerim ha'item be'eretz Mitzrayim, for you were the strangers in the land of Egypt. And we're going to see that's a refrain that repeats throughout the passages that we're going to look at. And then, so that's in verse 20. And then in verse 22, we expand beyond the stranger to what's here translated as a widow or an orphan. Again, we have then our third verb here, and you can see their translates the JPF translation, wrong, oppress, ill treat. They're all sort of synonyms in English different words to try to reflect the Hebrew that are all basically, you know, and here they're all with the, you can see the emphasis on the low, 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 not to mistreat or abuse not only the stranger, but here also the widow and the orphan. And actually, what is translated here as orphan is really the fatherless. We have cases, for example, the stories of Elisha and Elijah, where we have widows who have children, and the widows and their children are both in a very vulnerable position. The key thing there is not having a male figure, a husband or a father, to provide for, advocate for the individual. So throughout the Bible, the widow and the fatherless and also the stranger represent the most vulnerable elements of society. And then we're told again not to mistreat them. And then why? And now, so we're given the second reason. So the first reason why not to mistreat the stranger or the orphan or the widow is because we were strangers in the land of Egypt. But now there's an additional element. And the passage here states, so if you cry out, if you mistreat them then, if you do mistreat them, I will hear their, first of all, they will surely cry out and I will hear their cry. Then the statement in verse 23 is that God's anger will blaze forth and I will put you to the sword. Your wives shall become widows and your children orphans. So I want to pause here, and if people would want to share their opinions about what are these two different reasons, reasons given as to why you should not oppress the stranger? How would you describe the tactics there that's being used? And also, here as well, in the first case, what is the connection between not oppressing the stranger and having been strangers in the land of Egypt? So if anyone want to reflect on what's the logic, let's just start with verse 20, the logic between the command not to oppress the stranger and then the statement that we were strangers in the land of Egypt. What's the implicit logic there?
Empathy.
So as a reminder, if you want to add your voice, press star 6 to unmute yourself, or you can post in the chat box. I see that Karen has posted reason 1, empathy, reason 2, punishment.
Right, right. So what I want you to, good. So I want you to see is sort of one's a more positive, you know, we see this often in the prophets, where there's the carrot and the stick. So the incentive here, what's calling upon your own sense of empathy, that the idea that you know firsthand what it feels like to having been strangers, and that should create a sense of empathy that should dictate then how you treat those other people who are in a vulnerable situation. That's really fundamental then. That's that idea both in all of these biblical texts and also in the Passover story as well. I mean, that's really critical. And then the other reason here is this threat and punishment. So the anticipation so the passage in a sense anticipates that might be not be enough, that this the sense of empathy might not be enough to get you to actually follow these commands, not to mistreat those who are vulnerable. So then there's the threat that comes from it, and we see what's the relationship here between the crime and the punishment?
The same thing happens to your family that you are doing to the others.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is very typical of what we find in terms of punishment in the Bible, that it's tit for tat, or the crime fits the punishment. So in this case, if you are going to mistreat the widow or the fatherless, then the punishment will be that your own wives will become widows and your own children will become fatherless. So that gets at this same, you know, sort of like the opposite of empathy. You know, that in that case too, it's not only that you were strangers, but in fact then you are going to be your own wives and children will know what it's like to be widows and orphans. So it's kind of the reverse verse of that. So we have both the call to the sort of this human emotion of, or the human drive to empathy, but also then the threat and punishment, and that is then supposed to dictate the way that we're going to treat the widow and the orphan. So let me share with you then, if we look at the comment then, sort of how some of the letters, this is a passage from one letter that draws upon this verse and this theme of being the stranger. This is from Ryan Bonfiglio, who's a Hebrew Bible professor at Columbia Theological Seminary, which is in the Atlanta area. So he writes, the term for stranger in Hebrew ger refers to those who have come from outside of the land to stay within the Israelite community. In the ancient world, the ger would have faced an uncertain existence. Lacking certain rights and privileges, they could easily be driven to the margins of society, left economically, socially, and politically vulnerable. Yet every major law code in the Hebrew Bible shows compassionate concern for the welfare of the ger. And then the letter continues a little bit, but then this is from the conclusion where he writes, I hope and pray that you will honor this radical ethic of love for neighbor and stranger in your words, actions, policies. In doing so, you will not only fulfill a commandment that is dear to many Americans, but you will also help us become a stronger, freer, more just nation. So that's a good example, I think, of the way that he as a Bible scholar is both explaining the biblical text, but also then connecting it and using it here as a message to our political leaders. And I should add that the letters are addressed to the president, vice president, and members of the cabinet of the Trump administration and the 115th Congress. And just, I should add on that we've actually had, a lot of the cabinet secretaries weren't confirmed when we started the project, and it's actually been really difficult to get an email address to send them. So I think we have only a couple of cabinet secretaries that are actually getting emailed this, and just a little to back it up a little bit about the mechanics of the letters. The letters are sent, it's also not easy to get email addresses for all of our senators and congressmen. You can't just send it to, Bob Casey at whatever, Pat Toomey. We had to actually purchase a list that included the chiefs of staff and the legislative directors for all 400 and something combined members of the House and the Senate. That list started out originally at over 1,000 people. Now, so in the course of the 54 days, a lot of people have unsubscribed, and so now that list is about 800 people that are getting the letters each day via email. We send them out via MailChimp, and they go to the White House, and then everyone else on the list, which is the cabinet secretaries that we've been able to get their information, and then the members of Congress. And, we are relying on the staff members to try to get it to the members of Congress. I print out and mail a letter to Trump and Pence that I mail every day, a hard copy. And I see someone had a question here. Do you know if anyone in the government are actually reading them? We do know of one Republican congressman whose chief of staff has been closely reading, and she has written to me on a number of occasions. We've actually had some nice correspondence where she's taken issues with the letters or had questions, and so we've actually had a nice back and forth. And she wrote a really beautiful email back when the first time she wrote, which saying that, keep the letters coming, people are reading them, that they articulate a vision of the world, of our country as we want it to be, we hope it'll be. So we've emailed back and forth. And beyond that, we're still trying to figure that out. We have we've tried via social media to try to get the attention of people in Congress and Senate. So we had HEC students who sent, we crafted a sample paragraph saying, describing the project and saying, this is happening. You're getting, your chief of staff and your legislative director are getting these emails every day. Are you reading your letters? So we had HEC students divided up the list of all the senators and tried to email them on their contact page. And we also have a thing up on our Take Action page of our website encouraging other people too. For congressmen and for some senators too, you can't even get an email through to them on their contact page unless you live in their district or in their state. So we've tried that. We also have a campaign on Twitter. We're now for the second half of the campaign where every day we're taking a different state, going in alphabetical order. So the first one was, I think, Alaska, saying with the names of the senators from that state, saying and with a tag to this particular letter, and we're encouraging people to retweet those so that the senators get them that way. So we're trying to get the attention of people in Washington. It would help a lot if we could get some bigger press. I gave an interview to the New York Times about the second or third week of the campaign. They sent a photographer out and took pictures of me walking my dog, and we were very excited to be getting pretty early on in the New York Times. And that was going to be part of a larger story about the rise of a more progressive religious voice in the wake of the Trump administration. And for whatever reasons, that story hasn't come out yet, which has been pretty disappointing. But I'm still hopeful that maybe before day 100, that story may come out, and I've been trying to get the attention of people in Washington Post, because I think that's really, that would be great. It's a great investigative story to figure out who's actually reading these letters. Are they having an impact? And that's where we're just kind of limited in our manpower in terms of how much of that we can do. We've put out press releases repeatedly. I've been trying to reach out to people, but just the publicity piece of it could be pretty much a full-time job. Forget, the editing, the letters, and everything else that goes along with it. So that's just a little bit sort of a long answer to the, do we know if people are reading them? We know one person is, and we hope others are. But we do know, in terms of, I'm not sure the most recent figures, but we have well over 2,000 people who subscribe. And on average, the on Facebook, for example, that usually the letters get several thousand views. So we know several thousand people are looking at the letters on Facebook as well. So we're very pleased with that audience. And the reality is it's day 54, so we still have a lot of days to go in terms of people people connecting. You know, if someone finds out about the day, about the project today, they still have 46 other letters, and all the prior letters are on the website. So please feel free to interrupt along the way. So let's move on to our next text, which is in the subsequent chapter in Exodus, and where we hear something similar, but with a slightly different wording, and I want to see what's different about it. So that verse reads, Ki ger lo tilchatz, ve'atem yedatem et nefesh hager, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. So I want to ask what to take a look at then, those two verses, if we can get them both on the same screen, and to see what is different about those two verses. What does the second verse add that's not in the first verse? Right, so I see a comment on the Nefesh Hager. So there we have more of a specific statement here. And so the question is, what are the implications there? And it's not just there, it's really specifying that it's not just, you know, sort of understanding on a intellectual level, but really gets at this issue of empathy. And it's interesting that the word that's used here is that you should know the nefesh of the ger. It doesn't say lev, and you'll notice it gets translated as feelings or heart, but nefesh is really sort of a person's inner being. My students, I'm always trying to get them not to translate nefesh as soul, but it's really the sense of sort of one's very very being. So Karen's comment is right, sort of making the assumption that everyone has this capacity, has the nefesh, and therefore the capacity of it, but to have empathy. And that's this verse, I think, really draws that out, that you really know in a very, like in your kitchkas, what it feels like to be a stranger in a foreign land, and that really should dictate how you act moving forward. So I have here a sample of another letter that is talking about this theme of the ger, and this is from Judith Plaskow, her larger letter, which she makes the point that all, except for Native Americans, everyone in the United States or their ancestors has come from somewhere, and that we all know what it's have the experience, either personally or in our family history, to have been immigrants. And so she writes, what would it mean for each of us, especially those charged with formulating immigration policy, to call to mind our own experiences of migration or those of our families, and to empathize with the new generation of migrants and refugees trying to reach these shores? So she makes the point that this theme of empathy, and that, and she writes a little bit earlier in the letter, she makes a point about this, the Exodus verses in particular, that she points out that these two verses from Exodus, this legal code, comes from a time when the Israelites are wandering. They're not yet settled in the land, but this is sort of theoretical, where they have the power to think about how are they going to live once they get to the land. And she writes that rather than reproducing the patterns of domination and subordination they themselves experience, the Bible demands the creation of a society in which all are welcome and safe. And I think that's a really interesting point and that she makes there about what this is, and maybe this is perhaps why this command is emphasized more than any others in the Bible, because it really goes against our nature is sort of to treat others the way that we have been treated, right? And that really, the Bible tells us to do otherwise, right? To treat other people the way that we want to be treated. But that's really what she's trying to argue, is that these verses are calling us to not to just treat, once the Israelites are in a position of power, not to become the type of power to which they were subject to, but to emphasize with the other, with the stranger. So that's a sense of her letter. So now let's move on to another passage in which we find the same similar command. And this is from Leviticus 19 from the Holiness Code. And I want to look at so if you take a look here at what is different about this passage, there's a couple things. So take a minute to look at the text, and then I'll ask you to think about what is different here than what we've seen before. Just take a minute to read it. So this passage begins, "V'chi yagor ilcha ger," when a stranger resides in your land, you shall not wrong him, similar verb to what we saw above. And then it continues that you should treat the stranger like a citizen. And then it continues to even add to that, ve'ahavta lo kamocha. And then we have the similar refrain, ki geirim hayitim be'eretz Mitzrayim. So we have a couple of comments here on the side that this, the one comment is it's citizenship and love, right, that it's not just that you shouldn't oppress him. Then it goes on, and now we have the commands so far in Exodus have largely been negative. You shall not mistreat the stranger, but now we have two positives. In fact, you should not only not wrong the stranger, but you should treat them like one of yourselves. That this there are legal implications of that, but also of societal implications in terms of level of acceptance that goes along with that. So that the stranger should be seen like one of you, and then even more that you should love the stranger as yourself, and we'll talk about what that means in a minute. And the other comment is just it's practical, not theoretical. And I think maybe what's behind that is beginning ki yagor itcha. So the idea of when a stranger resides in your land. So this is anticipating this as a this is acknowledging this as a reality, not something theoretical that's going to happen later, but this is something a reality that exists. So now I want to look at one line from a really beautiful letter by my teacher, Tamara Eskenazi, from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. And she talks about we published her letter on Valentine's Day, which seems fitting, and that's been kind of a fun thing about the project is to figure out the timing of the letters and coordinating them with certain holidays or other events as well. So, for example, President's Day, we had a sequence of five letters in a row that all mentioned different presidents. So, but hers was on Valentine's Day, and that week had a whole sequence of letters that were on different themes, but all included somewhere or another the word love. So, and she makes the point, love in the Bible is about commitment, loyalty, and action rather than feelings. To love others is to take responsibility for their well-being. And that's the commentator Jacob Milgram that makes a similar comment he about this verse. He writes that the command is not, it's practical, not platonic, and that this notion of loving others is expressed in your behavior, how you treat other people, and as Tamara says, it's about taking responsibility. And this is the same notion of love that we have in the Ve'ahavta, which is if you ever wonder how can we be commanded to love Adonai, what does that mean? It's really here not about an emotion, but really about loyalty and action and behavior. So that's a little sample of her letter. And now I want to look at one other place where we see, and this passage has the most difference. So take a minute let me just read, we'll read the English here, part of it. So the passage begins, this is from Deuteronomy, one of Moses' exhortations to the people, and it begins here with a question. V'atah Yisrael, ma Adonai Elohecha shoel me'imach. what does Adonai demand of you? And then it's pretty simple here, this list, that that you should love Yirah et Adonai Elohecha. You should have love or reverence for Adonai. Lalechet bechol drachav, you shall walk in God's ways. And then finally, here, similar to what we've seen in that we just read in the Leviticus verse about how to treat this, the stranger, ula ahava oto, and to love Adonai, and to serve God. So this is, and there's sort of echoes of, if you are familiar with the Micah 6:8 passage, God has told you what to do and what Adonai demands from you. Also there is kind of this similar summation of what God wants. And then if we skip ahead to the end of the passage, to verses 17, and then we have this description of Adonai. So it says, for Adonai, your God is supreme, is God supreme and Lord supreme, and the Hebrew here will sound, if you look at the Hebrew, ki Adonai Elohecha hu Elohei ha-Elohim, Varonei ha-Adonim, Ha'el, Hagadol, Hagibor, V'Hanora, I'm assuming this sounds familiar to you, Asher lo yisa fanim, v'lo yikach shochad. So this idea of kind of God is depicted here as the ideal judge, the great God who doesn't take any bribes, Oseh mishpat, yatom v'almana, again, this reference to God here, sort of this depiction of the ideal judge or king who cares for those, the vulnerable, V'ohev ger, so, and who loves the stranger, as we've seen. And then if we skip on to verse 19, so that's all of that is describing God, is describing God. And then in verse 19, the focus shifts. And then the focus is on the behavior of human beings. Vahavtem et hager, kigerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. So we have the same phrase that we've seen elsewhere, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. But what I want to ask is, how is this articulation, so we've seen before this idea that you were strangers in the land of Egypt, we've seen this command to love the stranger, but what's different about it in this passage?
Well, that God's self, loves the stranger.
Yeah. So in this case, it's giving a different rationale. So this is different, for example, than what we saw earlier, where because it's a threat of punishment, or because we still have that you were strangers. But here, this is really saying this is how God takes care of the stranger, and the orphan and the widow, and therefore so should we. So this idea that we were created in God's image, that there are certain expectations that has for us. And so if you look on this is the point that I make in this. You're the only ones who will ever see this letter because it's not going to get published. I wrote a couple of different letters when we first sent out invitations just to give people a sense of what these letters might look like. So this was one that's not going to get published, but and this comes from my interest in metaphors for God. So, but here I make the point that was just made, if we are created in God's image, then we must watch how God operates in the world. And kind of there looking for metaphors, but that's sort of the similar point here, that why is it that we should love the stranger? Because that's how God acts in the world, and that's how we want to model our behavior. So that is a sample there of the various Hebrew Bible passages that deal with this theme of how do we treat the stranger. But the Hebrew Bible is not the only sacred scripture that also creates this same theme. So we find a similar message in Matthew, a number of other passages from the New Testament, but this is actually, this passage from Matthew is the one that is one of the most commonly quoted New Testament passages. And this is, it describes what's sometimes called the final judgment, where God is separating the righteous who are described as sheep and the goats who are the not righteous. So Jesus says to them, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. And then the people, the righteous, answer him, and they say, Lord, when was it that we saw you and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? When was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And Jesus answers them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, so you did to me. Mm-hmm. And this phrase, actually, the least of these, is one, that phrase is invoked in many, many letters. That's this idea of helping, that kind of that phrase in itself, the least of these, kind of encapsulate all of those different categories of those who are in need. So the point of this passage is that Jesus is saying, when you treated other people in this way, in terms of providing food and clothing and welcoming the stranger, etc., is as if you did this for me. So let me bring in a couple of letters from Christian scholars to show the points that they make about this. So the one is by Uriah Kim, who writes, in my humble opinion, as someone who follows the teachings of Jesus Christ, America is great not only because of its power, but more so because of its generosity and compassion. Jesus taught that in the end, nations and peoples will be judged not by what we say or believe, but by what we do for the most vulnerable in the world, the hungry, the stranger, the sick, and the imprisoned. And then there's another letter that I'll let you read because we're running out of time, but it's kind of that also evokes this with the message at the end here. Jesus makes it clear that what really counts is not whether we become his followers and called him Lord, but how we act in the world, especially how we treat those who are vulnerable and in need, those who are hungry, thirsty, foreign, naked, sick, or jailed. So two examples of how the letters deal with that passage. And then I wanted to bring in a passage from the Quran. This is from a recent letter by Amir Hussein, a Muslim scholar, where we see a similar theme. Serve God and do not associate anything with God, and be good to both your parents and to the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the neighbor who is near and the neighbor who is farther away and the companion by your side and the stranger and those whom your right hand possesses. Surely God does not love the one who is proud, boastful. And he makes the point here that the Quran is explicit that our doing good and showing beauty is not limited to our family, but also applies to those in need, whether they are literally our neighbor or far away. So you can see how this theme of caring for the stranger runs throughout Jewish, Christian, and Muslim texts. And actually, Amir Hussein's letter quotes a passage from the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran, and really draws them together. So I'll leave you, I put together a bunch of letters that you can take a look at, all on what various authors have to do with what it means to be created in God's image. That's a really central theme, either that particular text or the idea. So just to give you a sense of diversity, I have a bunch of different authors. And then this is kind of hot off the presses that I wanted to share with you. This is the bonus for joining this call, is this is a prayer for our country that I just put together yesterday. We're going to use this. I was asked to give the prayer for our country at ordination this year, and I wove this together with quotes from the various letters. So you're welcome to use that or to share that. We're running out of time, but if anyone has any last-minute questions about the project.
So I do have one last question. I'm wondering if anything has come about as a result of doing this. Have any other sort of side projects sprung up that you know about, that sort of a thing?
Some things are information. We've gotten a lot about, what after the 100 days. I have a phone call with someone from a more national organization about that. But we did get a great letter one day, and this is a quickly little backdrop of someone in Wisconsin, and he's trying to get together a group of people to read it, and we actually we branded a little logo, and he has a Facebook page that's called In Conversation with Values and Voices, with that our designer made for him, and so he's trying to get together people to read the letters and be in conversation. We know that there's a rabbi, Rabbi Carroll in New Mexico, who is, he's had a number of community-wide conversations. I know these letters are being used in religious schools of different faiths in a lot of different ways. So that's a quick answer.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I think with that, we are going to close the session. If you have any further questions, you're welcome to email me at alumni@atc.edu, and I will forward them on to our presenter.
Dina, can I say one more thing before we end?
Please.
And that is, if anyone has other questions, you can email me at aweiss@huc.edu, and I would just encourage you to share the project, to follow us on, if you're on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, to also share it with your congregation. Encourage people to subscribe. There are still 46 more letters, so I guess 45 after today. So thank you.
This was wonderful. Rabbi Weiss, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing this learning and sharing your journey with this. It's incredible, and I speak for myself and hopefully the alumni when I say how appreciative we are that you are doing this and that you're able to share this learning with us. This is really marvelous.
Thank you.
To our alumni, thank you all for participating. Again, you will receive an evaluation link. Please do share your thoughts on today's session and any other sessions you participated on so that we ensure that we are creating learning that meets your interests and needs. And with that, we are going to close today's session. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.